Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our weekly podcast on American constitutional law. This is Jenny, glad to be joining you again. And this week, we will be talking about what is called federalism, or the division of power between the national or federal government, confusingly enough, and the state governments across the United States. Let's jump right into tackling that topic. If you can, please navigate to Canvas and open the Week 10 Federalism slides. Our goals for this episode: we're going to introduce and discuss federalism, and we're going to learn a little bit more about how it's changed over time, because federalism, this division of power between the national and the states, has really evolved in pretty significant and important ways. And we want to look at that evolution and think about how did that change or shift in power over time come about, either as a result of the Supreme Court, or how did it modify the way the Supreme Court approached questions about that division of power between the national and the states. Then we're going to jump into our different cases related to federalism. We have quite a few this week where it's going to be a surface level conversation. And then we'll, of course, talk a bit more about our different layman's terms cases. For each of those cases this week, we have a critical concept that I will introduce and talk about, rather important things that will come up consistently in future cases with the Supreme Court, topics like commandeering, or principles around what the federal government can make the states do, or even thinking about things like dual sovereignty, which is how do we share power when we know that the national government has its own valid power sources and the states do too? What do we do when we've got dual sovereigns? I mean, this would be functionally the equivalent of saying, hey, we have two different kings here and both have a right to have a say. So whose say goes? Okay, let's get right into the conversation around the different federalism arrangements that exist. This is what's pictured on slide 3 here. We in the United States have something that is quite unique in terms of structure, or at least it was when it first came about. Within the United States, we have a true federalist structure. That's the picture on the right-hand side of slide 3, where you see there's arrows back and forth between the central government and the state governments. Now, prior to what we see with the Constitution, which is a balancing between these two levels, most governments that existed were either unitary, where the central government passes the power down to the different states, but they don't really get to push back on the central government, or you had something much more like what the Articles of Confederation represented, which was a confederal system, hence the name Articles of Confederation. Makes sense, right? In a confederal system, what's happening is the states are the central power points or the locus of power, and then they relay that information to the central government. It's much more a weak central government and the states have all the power. With a unitary structure, it's much more that the central government has a great deal of power and the states don't really have so much. So what we come across with the United States in the late 1780s and the early 1790s is this weird balancing structure. And that's kind of matching to the graphic that I have on the introduction for these slides. That first slide is the scales of justice, but it's balancing Washington, D.C. versus the states. And that's really what we're trying to strike here, is some sort of better balance, because the Articles of Confederation had too much power with the states, and that leads to the crumbling of the central government. But the framers and founders certainly don't want a unitary system like what they had seen under the King of England. So we are in the federal structure, and what that looks like in the Constitution is a very clear listing of certain powers, no mention of other powers, and kind of these other weird categories where the power could be shared. So jump to slide 4, and what I've got identified on that screen or on that slide is the enumerated powers, which are the listed powers, the powers that were denied to certain governments, things that are identified under bullet or icon number 2 on that graphic, concurrent powers, which are powers that are shared between the federal government and the state governments, And then the reserved powers. And reserved powers here are powers not so much listed in the Constitution, but things you would find with, say, the 10th Amendment, which says that all of the powers not explicitly listed in the Constitution are reserved to the states. So that's what reserved powers means. It's kind of a catch-all for all of these other things that are out there that don't get listed specifically in the Constitution. So again, enumerated is the listed powers. The powers denied are things that are actually listed in the Constitution and belong just to the federal government or just to the state government. So you can see that state governments don't get to tax imports and exports. They don't get to make their own money. They don't get to go and enter treaties with foreign countries. There are things that are restricted to just the federal government. And then there's things restricted just to the state governments. So in the Constitution, we are working out what this balance is. We're trying to figure out, okay, so which side gets which elements so that we keep this balancing, you know, pendulum somewhere at a point of functional so that the states can operate themselves and that the Constitution supports the creation of an actual central government that can survive more than, you know, a few years and certainly persist into the future. So if we look even further back at the historical evolution of federalism in the United States, we initially came at proposals around the distribution of power between two different options. There was the Virginia Plan and the New Jersey Plan. And what you'll see on slide six is some graphics that show some elements of each plan very, very simply presented, right? I don't want to make seem like the Virginia Plan and New Jersey Plan were just these very simplistic elements. But at their base level, what the Virginia Plan said was we need a bicameral or two-house legislature, and we need representation based on population, right? The role of the national government here is it can full-on legislate for states and veto state law. So the Virginia Plan is very strong on the central government components. Now, the New Jersey Plan, by contrast, says, okay, we want a unicameral or a single house legislature. We want state-based representation so that each state has the same number of representatives allocated, right? This is fundamentally what sets the stage for the construction and setup of the Senate. And then the role of the national government here, you know what? They're there for defense, but you're definitely not going to step on the state's toes. This is that don't tread on me flag written into, you know, a formal structure. And these different plans were touted by two very opposed but important framers in our Constitution and very important founding kind of idealists, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. For all of those of you who've seen anything like the Broadway production of Hamilton, I'm sure that there is so much in that that you would want to get into. But for the purposes of this episode, we're going to limit this to saying Hamilton is your Federalist guy. He wants a strong central government. He wants a national bank. He really wants to build up the national structures so that the federal government has power. We've seen what's happened with, you know, the Articles of Confederation and the breakdown after the Revolutionary War. We see the inability of the country to pay its veterans. You see things like Shays' Rebellion, which all of this is pointing to him to a need for a stronger central government. And he very much articulates this position and becomes one of the leaders of the Federalist Party. In fact, Hamilton isn't just one of the founders. He is identified as the founder of the Federalist Party. Now, in contrast to this, you have Thomas Jefferson, who comes at the conversation around federalism from a very different perspective. Jefferson is really on the states' rights, states' power side, because he's got concerns about what happens when you turn over too much authority and power to a central government. Look, we've just come from this, right? We don't need to be shifting more power in the direction of some sort of central authority when that can be so easily abused. And this presents alternative visions of the balance of power, with the Federalist Party led by Hamilton really pushing for more consolidation of national government power and basically taking on more power as it grows. And Jefferson and what is called the Democratic Republican Party at the time pushing back and saying, no, we need to leave this more with the states. Now, Jefferson and James Madison were the founders of that Democratic Republican Party. It is definitely the setup in our federal government, and essentially with what happens afterward at the state level, of our first political parties, which, of course, if you know a little bit about history, was something that most of the founders and framers said was a true evil, and yet they piled right on board and went ahead and created them, even though none of them felt that this was going to be a positive development in the politics of the United States. So while that helps us understand federalism at the founding of our country, it doesn't really tell us the story of the evolution of federalism. And so what I've tried to build out on slide 8 is more of an introduction to how that has transitioned over time. We have definite blocks of time with different types of federalism that kind of illustrate the balance between national and state. So between 1787 and 1865, we're talking all the way up to the end of the Civil War, you have what's known as state-centered federalism. So the states are really the locus of power and control here. The federal government is just trying to get its legs underneath it, and we see a lot of threats and challenges to that. It's a back and forth between parties like the Federalists and the Democrat Republicans, and the different proposals that come to Congress or the different decisions that the Supreme Court gets to make at this point in time, like McCulloch v. Maryland, where we're debating who has authority to tell who to do what. Is it the states getting to tell the federal government to do something? Is it the federal government getting to tell the states to do something? How is this going to work out? And states were the main political power during this entire period of time. Most people, in fact, would have called themselves more by their state identity than they would have by their national identity. I'm a Nebraskan, or I'm a Georgian. I'm not a U.S. citizen, right? I may be both of those things, but the primary identity that people associated with politically at this time was their states. Those represented the strongest kinds of points of power and the things that bound people to one another. So you have these different states, these different pockets of power, and that's the state-centered federalism structure, where the states have more authority and there's a lot of deference to those states. But post-Civil War, we shift into an era known as dual federalism. And dual federalism is this much more articulated and expected recognition that the federal government does have a fair amount of things where it is allowed to assert its authority and to be the dominant government and power on that topic, right? The states and the federal government end up having their own kind of respective areas of power, as I've noted on this slide. So states get certain topics and the federal government keeps their hands off, and the federal government gets certain topics and the state tries to keep their hands off. And this extends even into the era of cooperative federalism up to where we are seeing kind of the height of the civil rights movement. We're talking about the 1960s. So between 1865 and 1964, we have a period of about 100 years where there is pretty good cooperation and sharing of power. And then we shift into what is called centralized federalism. This is mid-1960s to about 1980. And centralized federalism is this much stronger push for power by the central government. So in this era, the U.S. government located in Washington, D.C. is trying to start to do things like entice the states to behave in a certain way. If you think about things like the drinking age, the way that the drinking age moved in most states from the age of 18 to 21 was the federal government putting grant funds out and saying, hey, states, do you want us to help pay for your highway system? Jack up your legal drinking age and we'll give you allocations of funds for that. But if you don't, we'll just not give you that money to work on your roads. There was very much a kind of negotiated compromise around funding. But then after we go through an era where it's kind of let's put the money on the table and see what happens, then we trend into new federalism and coercive federalism. New federalism and coercive federalism all happened during the Reagan era. New federalism is a lot more of this, hey, we're going to actually just make money available to the states as these kind of block grants. So we're going to try and give states a bit more power to say what they do with the money. This is another kind of rebalancing. But post-1985, coercive federalism is the push not to simply give states that ability to say what they want to do with the funds. It's much more stringent. Okay, you want these funds, here are the conditions for it. And the federal government went so far as to say, guess what? Even if you don't take the funds, or even if we don't offer the funds, we're going to make it expected that you're going to make these changes in your laws and in the ways that you govern. What these were called were mandates. And states generally could count on the federal government early on to provide money to help them with mandates, but by the end of the mid-1990s, states were getting unfunded mandates. You have to do this, and you have to follow these expectations from the federal government. And by the way, we're not going to give you any money to help you pay for this. Find a way to make it work. Sounds a little bit less than cooperative by that point in time. And that's definitely how the states felt. And what we see throughout this entire evolution is a shift, right? There is a clear division of power. There is a clear dominance by the states, pushing towards a clear dominance by the central government. And even in terms that's very coercive, we're pushing states to be the way that the central government wants them to be, without giving them support. It's more of a, you will do this because I said so, which of course was, I'm sure, so effective anytime that God said to you. If we move to thinking about a different analogy for federalism, and you click over to slide 9, what you can see there are the two types that have been put forth, the layer cake federalism and the marble cake federalism. Layer cake federalism is where we have clear divisions between the national and the state and the local governments. Each takes care of its own respective area, and they keep in their space their place. They don't tend to try to reach out and take over any one area. This is a lot cleaner, generally speaking, and easier for something like a Supreme Court to say, okay, this is your respective area that you can work in. And again, that's simpler than when we transition to what is considered to be our present structure, which is marble cake federalism. So with this, it's just like the picture. The programs, the authority, the power is mixed between the national government and the state government and the local government. An example I can suggest to you right now is emergency management. With emergency management, you generally have a local authority who is able to direct funds from your city or your county and to oversee processes and programs to respond to a situation like a flood, a tornado, something of that nature. But your state also has the ability to step in and do that because the state will have an emergency management entity or agency itself. And then, of course, we have the federal agency or entity like FEMA that can step in and play a role in those disaster situations. But, okay, now we have mingling or overlap between all three different levels. Who gets to have the primary say in this situation? Well, the local entity is probably going to have the most information in some sort of emergency management or disaster scenario, but they're certainly not going to have the resources that the federal government has. And this introduces all sorts of questions about who gets to have ultimate say, right? Bring it all back to this question of power, because federalism is ultimately about power. This is what the Supreme Court has had to contend with respect to federalism, and we've had different justices take very different approaches. So the first really powerful justice, John Marshall, is a member of the Federalist Party. And as you can imagine, that does influence his decisions. So let's look a little bit at the court's application and interpretations related to federalism as it you know, is kind of laid out, or not so laid out, in the Constitution. And let's go back to the Marshall area. Let's begin with McCulloch v. Maryland in 1819. McCulloch v. Maryland, super interesting case where what we have is a bank created by the national government in the context of a very, let's say, tumultuous economic time and situation. We've had major issues with keeping banks alive. The First National Bank has actually already been in existence and gone out of existence before. So this is the Second National Bank. And there's this power battle between the state of Maryland and the national government. Now, we can get into the minutiae and the case details. I mean, this really comes about literally based on an issue of taxing specific forms of paper, right? The paper that is used for printing, and does the federal government get to be taxed by the state of Maryland for using that paper? Who has ultimate authority? But the base layer, the foundation, what's underneath all of this is this contentious debate over power. Is it the states or is it the federal government? And there's this very famous quote that I've captured on the slide from Chief Justice Marshall. The question respecting the extent of the powers actually granted is perpetually arising and will probably continue to arise as long as our system shall exist. So at its core, Justice Marshall says, look, this is part and parcel of what we're going to be dealing with. We will always have to talk about the division of powers. We're always going to have to think about who gets to say, this is mine. Is it the federal government or is it the states? And there's some important principles that come out of this case and this decision. And I kind of want to hit on these just quickly to highlight where this sets us up for the Federalist breakdown. Now, number one, enumerated powers ought to be seen as the means to the accomplishment of certain ends. Okay, so Marshall is putting this out there, saying as long as whatever the government, the federal government in this question or in this case, as long as what they want to do is legitimate, it's constitutional, right? If it's within the scope of the Constitution, the means are quote unquote appropriate, okay? They serve those ends. It's fine. If the federal government is doing something that's listed as a power in the Constitution and they're using a means that makes sense there, like, you know, with respect to this bank, the bank is about different functions like the welfare of the country or coining money or, you know, spending and all of that. Those are listed powers, enumerated powers in the Constitution under Article 1. So of course the United States can create a bank because that is an appropriate way to get to those final endpoints, those goals that are listed as actual functions of the federal government. Now, next step, important kind of segue. The argument here then turns to those reserve powers out of the 10th Amendment. And Marshall says, the 10th Amendment constitutes no bar to a broad construction of even the incidental or implied powers of the national government. Oof, this is a really charged kind of statement. It may not feel that way because, of course, it's very technical. But what Marshall is saying is, guess what? The 10th Amendment doesn't mean that there aren't powers for the federal government that aren't listed in the Constitution. There are things not written in the Constitution that are federal powers. And the 10th Amendment doesn't stand up as something that can stop the federal government from taking those powers. There are implied powers, things that weren't specifically written out. And in this case, that implied power could be the power to create a bank, which the state of Maryland has no authority to try and condemn or shut down or put out of business, which is really the back and forth between the banks that's going on at this time. The final thing that comes out in the decision related to McCulloch v. Maryland is an emphasis on what is called the Supremacy Clause. Supremacy Clause is Article 6, Paragraph 2, and it's listed on slide 13. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Okay, layman's terms translation of this. This constitution is the ultimate law. You cannot have something that trumps this. This is the ultimate trump card, okay? No state laws, no state constitutions can be thrown up against this and stand if they are found to be in direct conflict with the Constitution. So McCulloch v. Maryland, this power battle between federal and state involving the case of this bank, and it's a rather interesting read if you take the time to get into the case details and Mr. McCulloch, who was the one who pushed back on the taxes for the paper. Yeah, all super fascinating and interesting, kind of fun, right? McCulloch's not exactly the most amiable guy if you read the case details, but the point with this case, you have a Federalist Chief Justice saying, we're going to define and construct the power of the central and national government very broadly because that is allowable under our interpretation of the Constitution. And this continues. We move into other things like the case in 1816, which, again, this is before McCulloch v. Maryland, but Martin versus Hunter's lessee in 1816 is actually an earlier expansion of power where the Supreme Court says, hey, guess what? We don't just get to have authority over federal cases. We get to review state court cases when those involve federal law, right? We have the power to overrule entities like the Virginia Supreme Court, right? The Virginia Supreme Court here is looking at a land dealing, right? Between a British subject who was a loyalist and an act of the Virginia legislature, which said, hey, no, we're not going to give land to individuals who were former loyalists. We're going to transfer it to people who are Virginians. And the issue at play is, does a federal treaty get to overrule Virginia law? And the Supreme Court jumps in and says, yes, absolutely. This is the earlier case before we get to McCulloch that talks about the Supremacy Clause gives the federal courts and specifically the Supreme Court the power to review those state court decisions and to say, guess what? Those decisions don't hold up. We've got judicial review established of other courts, specifically state courts. Now, the year after, or 2 years, excuse me, after McCulloch, we're in 1821, Cohens v. Virginia. We have an act of Congress, and we then have the Virginia Supreme Court again stepping in, right, to say that, guess what, this act of Congress is in violation of state law. We're going to say that according to this, the state's law is going to stand. Supreme Court jumps in again, and we are having to seriously complete this reevaluation each and every time, who gets to have the power and the say? And the battle isn't so much between Congress and state laws, it's actually between the state Supreme Courts and the federal Supreme Court. Cohens v. Virginia, the Supreme Court, does it have the power to review a Supreme Court ruling from Virginia? Of course it does. We are saying it's not simply about the Constitution either. We have other federal law, Section 25 of the Judiciary Act. So this Supremacy Clause, again, says the Constitution and federal laws. I want to go back to that language. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. So federal law, including the Constitution, is going to trump state law. And we're going to expand on this and say, guess what? It's not just that. It's that the Supreme Court here of the United States has the power to overrule state Supreme Courts. Everything I've laid out so far is what happens during state-centered federalism, and then we run into this massive and really life-changing event in the course of U.S. history, which is the Civil War. So what about what happens with respect to the post-Civil War era? Because we have at this time what a lot of historians call the second founding of our country. And it's the second founding because there are some really, really important shifts and changes made with respect to the Constitution and with respect to the balance of power between the central government and the state governments. Those fundamental shifts are the post-Civil War amendments, none more important than the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Now here's the important language. "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Now, there's more to the 14th Amendment. There's actually multiple sections to this that are important to read through, and it's come up a lot more with respect to the election in this year, 2024. But what this really emphasizes is that the states are now bound, right? They are literally bound in writing in an amendment to the Constitution to adhere to these expectations. The Second Founding is an extension of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to incorporate them to the states. This is really important. Incorporating is what is done when we apply the Bill of Rights to the state governments, and it wasn't an option before we have the 14th Amendment, where the 14th Amendment says these things must be done by the states. The Supreme Court has slowly incorporated or brought the Bill of Rights into and applied it to the states. This is called selective incorporation. But this 14th Amendment makes all of that possible. It extends and expands the Constitution to a realm of having more authority and more power over the states, which by consequence means there's more national power. We had a block of amendments at around this time. The 13th and the 14th are pretty quick succession within one another, then the 15th, and then it's going to shift, right? The 16th Amendment has nothing to do with the Civil War. It's got to do with the Congress being able to tax your income. It is the creation of the national income tax. This is in 1913. So this is significantly after the period in time that we're talking about. But what we need to think about is, okay, so the pendulum, right? This swinging pendulum between national power and state power. It's just made a very strong swing towards national power. And the entire period of state-centered federalism was the states having dominant power, but pushing the pendulum a bit more each time towards the national government, giving it more and more power. And then we have the 14th Amendment, which puts the states underneath the federal government a little bit more than it was before. Well, what we have seen over the course of time is this continued pendulum swing more and more towards central government, but post-1964, the states have made much more of a pushback. More of a comeback, you might call it. So a few cases that I want to highlight from the era of what we would call either centralized federalism or new federalism, or even up to coercive federalism. Younger versus Harris, 1971, okay? This is a really interesting case because it flies in the face of what we've already talked about when we were looking at things like Martin versus Hunter's Lessee or Cohen's v. Virginia. In Younger v. Harris, Harris is convicted under this Criminal Syndicalism Act in the state of California. Now, criminal syndicalism is essentially you're part of a crime syndicate by the actions you're taking. Maybe you're a socialist, and we think socialists are criminal syndicates, or kind of like, you know, organized crime. So if you're partaking in that and you're speaking that way, we're going to charge you under this law. Harris is going to challenge this, right? Because this appears to be a clear violation of his First Amendment right. And the Supreme Court comes back and says, well, here's the deal. Just because it's possible that a state's laws may violate the Constitution, it doesn't mean the federal courts have the right to stop the states from enforcing their laws. That's a bit of a head scratcher, right? Because what we've had before is a clear declaration of the Supremacy Clause. What are we saying here in 1971? That states can have unconstitutional laws? Well, in Younger v. Harris, that is what we come away with. Now, 1978, a few years down the road, let's talk about more with respect to the 14th Amendment. Baldwin v. Montana Fish and Game Commission. Okay. In Montana, in this case, if you're a non-resident, you have to pay more to hunt elk. makes sense when you are an out-of-state individual. We see this all across the United States. A resident permit is cheaper than a non-resident permit for things like hunting, fishing. And Baldwin sues and says this violates the Privileges and Immunity Clause from the 14th Amendment. The Privileges and Immunity Clause, just to be very clear, is where it says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And Baldwin's argument is my privilege and or right under this Privileges and Immunities Clause includes hunting in the state of Montana, even though I'm not a resident of Montana. And the Supreme Court comes back with this and says, we're not going to consider this a privilege and immunity, only with respect to those privileges and immunities bearing upon the vitality of the nation as a single entity must the state treat all citizens, resident and non-resident, equally. Okay, they're not going to go for hunting being a privilege or an immunity. It's not vital to the nation. Okay, so let's jump again, but much further this time, about 20 years down the road, Arizonans for English versus the state of Arizona. Now, in 1997, Arizona has a ballot initiative, meaning that it's going to the people to pass this law. Are we going to make English the official language of the state of Arizona? And we have an Arizona state employee suing this, saying this violates the free speech clause of the First Amendment. The argument here is not really one that the Supreme Court deals with because they call the case moot. Go all the way back to some of our earlier podcast episodes. Remember what mootness is? Mootness is really that this is no longer a live controversy or case. The individual in question has actually already resigned before the decision is issued, right? She's left Arizona state government. She's done with it. Which means the question is no longer a live case or controversy. But the Supreme Court goes further to say the states deserve more respect than it was given by the prior court decisions in this case. So there's a little bit of recognition. There's a little bit of acceptance by the Supreme Court at this time that there's more arguments in favor of state power. We're seeing that pendulum, that swing back towards the states. And we're going to see it even further in a few cases that I'm going to describe here in a minute. But what's going to come about in this conversation is now we're going to start getting nitpicky and talking about the different clauses in the Constitution and where do we draw the line. One of the big clauses that has been used by the federal government and by Congress in particular to enforce a lot of its power and authority or to extend its power and authority is the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause is Article 1, Section 8. It's Clause Number 3. And what it says is that Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Okay, but what qualifies as commerce? This is a very vague term as it's put forth. Does this mean all of trade? What does the, do we think about if you're producing something, is that commerce? The early applications of the Commerce Clause are really, really extensive. And one of the most interesting is Wickard v. Filburn, which happens in 1942. Okay. So Filburn is a farmer in Ohio. He has like 12 acres of wheat that he's harvested, which go above his allotment or his allowance under what's known as the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938. Okay. You have limits on what you can harvest. He goes beyond and he says, but I'm using this just for my family, just for me and my family. It's not going to be affecting commerce. It's not going to be changing the trade situation because I'm not putting this into the market for trade. I'm simply using it to eat. And so he's saying this does not fall to regulation. It's not part of commerce. And the Supreme Court is just kind of astoundingly all for the Commerce Clause application here, saying even though there is a limited likelihood that this individual's going to have an effect on the market, right? His 12 acres of wheat aren't going to make a huge difference. Congress has the power to regulate that because Congress has the power to regulate prices in the industry as a result of the Commerce Clause. And this can be any individual level activity, even if it has a quote unquote trivial effect. So 12 acres of wheat, boy, that's a pretty small amount and a pretty limited effect on commerce. And yet the Supreme Court in Wickard v. Filburn in 1942 says, yep, nope, that's quite all right. That can fall under the Commerce Clause. So the Commerce Clause has a lot of question and contention. We're actually going to get back into this conversation a bit more later on because the past interpretations have been very broad. But in 1995, we're going to get a case that's talked about in this chapter, United States v. Lopez, which is actually about weapons-free zones in schools. Under the Commerce Clause, again, Congress is attempting to pass a law about gun-free school zones, okay? You get this case, a 12th grade high school student, Alfonso Lopez, who has a concealed weapon in his high school, and they charge him with violating the federal criminal statute, which was created, again, under the Commerce Clause, or was argued to exist for Congress under the Commerce Clause. Is that a valid argument? In this case, we start to see that pendulum backswing. The Supreme Court says the possession of a gun is not an economic activity, which might have a substantial effect on interstate commerce, okay? It's got nothing to do with commerce. Making the argument that this is a commerce case is, frankly, rather laughable, at least to the five justices who voted with the majority. This is a 5-4 decision. And the four justices who are in the minority are saying, no, we've been pretty broad. I mean, if we have found that 12 acres of wheat that someone's going to use on their own falls under commerce, maybe this is also something that could be an economic activity. But that being said, what we're seeing in this case in particular is that backswing, right? We're pushing back on the federal government on this coercive federalism dynamic to try and put more balance of power into the state's court, so to speak. Yeah, bad analogy, sorry. I will leave that in there, though, for a good chuckle in case you need it. So, all right, how does this, all of this compare to what's going on today? How does this interpretation of United States v. Lopez look if we look at other topics like the Comstock case? Think all the way back to United States v. Comstock. And remember in that case, what the Supreme Court was dealing with was the Necessary and Proper Clause. Well, now they're dealing with the Commerce Clause. What makes the Commerce Clause so fundamentally different from the Necessary and Proper Clause? I'd like you to dig in a little bit on the reasoning. Compare what the book says about U.S. v. Lopez and relate it back to that U.S. v. Comstock case. The interpretation of the clauses, is it very broad? Is it narrowing? How are they approaching each of these? And what are they looking at? Are they looking at the enumerated powers? Are they thinking about implied powers? How is the court tracking on these different types of cases? Thinking more about what's going on in the present day, federalism has become a much more contentious topic or issue, and you don't really need to do too much digging to figure that out. If you've followed the news with respect to any number of cases, we had student loan forgiveness, which was Biden v. Nebraska, the states challenging the federal government's authority to forgive student loans. We've seen Texas push back on the federal government with respect to border. We've even seen different cases already in this class. Something like, you know, Arizona's SB 1070 or Arizona's push for English language as a state language. These are all much more recent visions and pushes from the states regarding the division of power. And as you can see on slide 22, this is certainly far from the end of the conversation because we are seeing many more multi-state lawsuits filed against the federal government, meaning you have clusters of states suing the federal government to push back on what the federal government wants. And those numbers just keep going up. If you look at that graphic, keep in mind that we are talking about maybe two terms under Ronald Reagan, a total of 8 years, but only 4 years under George H.W. Bush, and then 8 years under Clinton, 8 years under George W. Bush, 8 years under Barack Obama. 126 multi-state lawsuits were filed against the Trump administration between 2017 and 2020. This is the trend with federalism. We are more and more calling in the Supreme Court to serve as the referee and to say, hey, this power belongs to the states or it belongs to the national government. And that is going to lead us down some pretty interesting pathways. And I honestly think that it will translate into much less love and support for the Supreme Court, because it's going to be called in to debate on issues like abortion and who gets to have the say. People react very strongly to those tender topics because often it comes down to very personal and strongly held beliefs. All right, so we've talked about the history of federalism, the evolution. Let's turn to the different cases that we have this week. I'm not going to spend much time talking about these cases because they are all layman's terms cases. Please do take the time to read through what's listed in the textbook. I would also encourage you to go to oyez.org, O-Y-E-Z.org, and look up the cases to learn a little bit more about them if you are not assigned a layman's terms handout for this week. But let's go back to 1883 with the Civil Rights case. The Civil Rights cases, that is. The Civil Rights cases are all about issues of what happens with public entities that may discriminate. I'm going to leave it there because I don't want to, again, give away the case facts or the questions. I want you to read that for yourself. But what happens when we involve private entities, perhaps, in a role where they're doing public functions? I don't know. Let's talk about things like Amtrak, where it's a government corporation, but it is selling train rides. That's a kind of crossover, right? With these types of cases, what's going to become really fundamental in our critical concept for them is what's known as state action. State action is tied into whether someone is able to sue related to discrimination, okay? According to this overall concept, if you want to file a suit under the 14th Amendment and relate it to discrimination, there must be some action taken by the state. There's got to be some level of government involvement, okay? The state must be a participant in some way, shape, or form. We have to have some collaboration with the government because what's listed in the Constitution is that it's the government you're protected from, right? The amendment, quote, erects no shield against merely private conduct, however discriminatory or wrongful, end quote. So state action. Big important concept. Is it state action if the government, let's say, gives a grant to a company who then behaves in a discriminatory fashion? Well, could you argue it either way? Is it state action if, let's say, an individual hires someone who is regularly law enforcement to provide private security at an event where the public may be attending? Ooh, I don't know. Where do we draw the line on the state's role? Does it have to be proactive? Or can it be more hands-off, something like awarding a grant and that being discriminatory and then being held liable for that? Okay, let's move forward to critical concept number two, which comes out of the case of Prince v. United States. Now, what you see in the picture here are county sheriffs Jay Prince and Richard Mack. Mack is pictured on the left in the sunglasses and uniform, and Jay Prince is on the right. Their attorney, David Hardy, is in the center there in this photo in front of the Supreme Court. And what you might imagine is that this case involves law enforcement. So you have two county sheriffs who are pushing back on the Brady Bill and the way that Congress wants this to be enforced. Again, no giveaway on the details of the case or the legal question, but we do have a dual sovereignty critical concept that comes up here. So dual sovereignty essentially means a recognition of two authorities, right? Dual sovereigns. And sovereignty refers to the ability to be the ultimate authority, the proper and correct authority over a certain topic or boundary. I'm going to pull a quote from the opinion in this case. Although the states surrendered many of their powers to the new federal government, they retained a residuary and inviolable sovereignty that is reflected throughout the Constitution's text. The framers rejected the concept of a central government that would act upon and through the states, and instead designed a system in which the state and federal governments would exercise concurrent authority over the people. So here we're talking about concurrent powers, shared powers between the federal and the state governments. What I want you to do as you read through this case, think about that concept of dual sovereignty and then go to the Stevens dissent and look at which clauses he references there. It's always going to come back to contents in the Constitution, right? We're dealing with constitutional law. What are these justices using? Are they using text? Are they using originalism? Stevens tends to be associated with a very different methodology or approach to judicial philosophy than those who adopt originalism. What is he arguing and what perspective does he come from? All right, just a few more cases to get through in this podcast. The next one is Alden v. Maine from 1999. Now, this is going to involve probation officers suing the state of Maine related to overtime issues, right? The Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. And that's all I'm going to give away on this one. Again, go back to the book. Read through that section. Make sure you go to OYA and follow up. But the critical concept in this case, and it's one that comes up in other cases before it, is what is known as sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity is essentially the idea that a state or a government or a sovereign cannot be sued unless they agree to it. It's a really interesting ideology. So if you're listening in the state of Nebraska, you can't sue Nebraska unless Nebraska says, yep, go ahead, sue us. They actually have to authorize it. This comes from the legacies of what existed under the king back before we were the independent United States. And it's actually at the heart of the 11th Amendment, the sovereign immunity idea. So as you're reading through Alden v. Maine, consider sovereign immunity and what you think of that concept. It's also very much present in other cases, like the Seminole Tribe v. Florida case of 1996. All right, final big case and critical concept for this section and for this set of topics that it's generally federalism is Murphy versus NCAA from 2017. So the fun picture here is on the left, you have Ted Olson, who we had previously mentioned in the cases about executive privilege. He's actually one of the people who was going to be investigated by a special investigator. He's the blonde individual on the left-hand side of the picture. And then on the right is Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey and was a former, candidate for the president. Always pictured out in front of the Supreme Court. That's where we got to get our pictures taken related to any of these cases. So 1992, Congress has this Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which is going to limit state sports gambling. And New Jersey's going to be like, we want gambling. We want to be able to do this at casinos and racetracks. Okay, so critical concept that comes into this case is what is known as commandeering. And commandeering is when the federal government attempts to force a state to take action, okay? It actually originally is really well articulated and spelled out in the case of New York versus United States from 1992. And that's where New York is basically being told by the United States, hey, deal with this radioactive waste thing, right? Like, just, you're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it. And New York is like, excuse me? So 1992 is that case, but this in 2017 brings up again the issue of commandeering. And in the 1992 case, the court said acts of Congress which would commandeer state governments are inconsistent with the division of authority and power between federal and state governments. So it's not like one entity or one level of government can hijack the other and force them into doing something. Which brings us all the way back to the very beginning. This balancing act between state and federal, what is the right approach? Justice Marshall had it right this will perpetually arise and continue to arise as long as we have a division of power between different levels of government. With those final thoughts, I will wrap up this episode. We do have a few upcoming assignments, not in the immediate term, but a little further down the line. That would include the initial draft of your papers. Those are due Sunday, November 3rd. Make sure you get them in on time so that you can get feedback during the peer review processes the week after those papers are due. Make sure you're staying on top of the layman's terms assignments. All of those handouts need to be submitted by November 17th. That's a little further down the line, but it's not too far out. And as always, email me with any questions or concerns so that I can get back to you as soon as possible. Have a great rest of your week, and I will follow up with you again soon with more discussions of state and national power.